Welcome to PA Bible Study Night, a podcast for our church members to delve deeper into the scriptures together to grow in understanding and relationship with God. If you're a friend of the church or new to PA Bible, we're excited for you to join us. Tonight, we'll survey the Psalms that display trust and confidence in God and the satisfaction that comes from a relationship with Him. Sam Pittenger leads us in tonight's study.
Well, we'll start here in Psalm chapter 4. Psalm 4, tonight we're looking at trust and satisfaction as our theme here. Like we did last week, we'll do a survey of some of these psalms, as opposed to a singular psalm. But we closed last week when we were looking at the majesty of God and His excelling greatness. And we closed marveling at, as the psalmist does in Psalm 145, the unsearchable greatness of God and His abundant goodness. And that goodness and greatness of God is displayed toward those who seek Him and who put their trust in Him. And so these psalms that we're going to look at tonight display trust and confidence in God and a satisfaction in that relationship with Him. And God's character and His majesty and who He is, His nature, are truly compelling. And so that's what we saw last week. And this week, now we're responding to how compelling God is by trusting Him and putting all of our trust in Him. One of the Psalms we read, Psalm 62, the psalmist says, "Trust in Him at all times, O you people. Pour out your heart before Him. God is a refuge for us." So we could read on the pages about the majesty and the greatness of God, and yet if He's not trustworthy to us, or we don't feel encouraged to pour out our hearts before Him, or we don't have a high view of His character and His attributes as trustworthy, this has a profound impact on our life. But when we do, that also has a tremendous impact on our life. And ultimately, what we'll see tonight is as things play out in real life, like they did for these psalmists, like they do for us, so does that trust in God. It plays out in real life through all circumstances. And though it may be hard, yet God is still abundantly good, and there's a blessedness and a satisfaction of trusting in Him. One thing that God is not after is our begrudging submission, which is some people's view of Christianity. It's begrudging submission. God's trying to keep us from enjoying life. God's trying to give us a bunch of things that hold us back from our true potential or put us in a box. And that's really not it. He doesn't want our begrudging submission. He wants our joyful trust. Because when we joyfully trust Him, it actually exposes His greatness. It shows and magnifies His excellence. Even taking a psalm like Psalm 23, very famous. "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters for His name's sake." All of what we are doing in trusting God is not because we have some great ability to do so, but because He is so excellent. When we trust in Him, it exposes to ourselves and to others the greatness of His name. In Psalm 4, we'll start. And like I said, we'll be surveying a bit, so we're going to go to several of these. But in verse 1, this one's to the choir master with stringed instruments, a psalm of David. So this would have been something collective or corporate that they used for worship. It says, "Answer me when I call, O God of my righteousness. You have given me relief when I was in distress. Be gracious to me and hear my prayer. O men, how long shall my honor be turned into shame? How long will you love vain words and seek after lies? Selah. But know that the Lord has set apart the godly for Himself. The Lord hears when I call to Him. Be angry and do not sin. Ponder in your own hearts on your beds and be silent. Selah." Here, David is speaking actually to his enemies, those who are against God's anointed king. They need to remember who he is and that God sets apart the godly for Himself. You'll notice in a lot of these psalms, David has a lot of enemies constantly. Verse 5, it says, "Offer right sacrifices. Put your trust in the Lord. There are many who say, Well, who will show us some good? Lift up the light of your face upon us, O Lord. You have put more joy in my heart than they have when their grain and their wine abound. In peace, I will both lie down and sleep, for you alone, O Lord, make me dwell in safety. One of the psalms that we're very used to stylistically is a psalm of thanksgiving. And a lot of times in a psalm of thanksgiving, you'll have these crises that are happening, but you also have a word of assurance that the crisis has passed and God has performed as he said he would, or he has come through in some magnificent way. But these sort of psalms of trust and confidence, trouble is still lurking in the shadows. And that's something here. We have no real clarification as to what happened. All we have is that it ended with a peaceful night's sleep, secure in God's hands. So trouble is still lurking. We'll notice that in many of these psalms. Yet his heart is fixed upon God's character despite this lurking trouble. And here it's showing us the satisfaction of a trusting relationship with God. In verse 6, there's many who are saying, who will show us some good? And David is saying, God will show us that good. When he lifts up his face upon us, when he shines upon us, that's when you'll see what good really is. So who will show us some good? Well, we have one we're pointing to. And he speaks to how crying out to God, even in the midst of this adversity and distress, still that was a deep source of joy for him. Even more joy than when the wine and grain abound. So even in their festival times, when they're specifically rejoicing at the harvest and the different celebrations and feasts, even more than those special times of celebration, crying out to God, God's face shining upon him, trusting in him in the midst of this distress, put so much joy into his heart. And again, joy and happiness, you know, you can lose your happiness pretty quickly. Joy is a quality of heart that comes from a truly knowing God and a deep satisfaction with him. And he says in verse 8, in peace, I will lie down and sleep. For you alone, O Lord, make me dwell safely. At the end of this day, it's that trusting and honest relationship with God that gave him peace of heart, that caused him to sleep soundly, knowing that God was the one who really keeps him. I think most people can relate to not sleeping soundly if they're worried about something or troubled. For me, probably far less than what the psalmist is dealing with here. But nonetheless, we all know how to lose sleep over something. This psalm is beginning with, answer me when I call. You have done that in the past. I'm dealing with these that distress me now. And it ends with God's unsearchable peace, to have joy and peace in the midst of trouble, that he sleeps soundly knowing God is keeping him. And so nothing changed in the situation, according to this psalm. The thing that changed was his state of heart and the peace that God gives in a way that only God gives it. One of the things that we all need to learn, and that these psalmists express well, and we'll see it as we go through, and we see it in this psalm number 4, is that we really must trust God for his character, who he is, not just for his outcomes. Often we may think that trust is constituted by a certain situational outcome. But understanding the unsearchable greatness of God and the abundant goodness of the Lord is to make us trust in him, not simply in what he does. You know, we'll joke about this like he's not a vending machine God, where you put in enough faith and enough prayers and he's stingy with his treats to you. That's not the idea of trusting God and a trusting relationship. It's who is he, and then to trust him. Not trusting God unless he does what we want him to do and what we think he should do is not trusting him, it's trusting ourselves. If we want a God who does what we think he should do, when we think he should do it, how we think he should do it, we don't want this God, we want an idol. So these psalmists teach us, like David does, that God really knows the righteous, the godly, and God really is righteous. So when you call out to him, to trust that he will be according to his character. He cannot act outside of his nature. He cannot be untrue to who he is. He cannot act against the grain of his righteousness and holiness. So that's something we all have to learn. A lot of times we'll go, well, I'll believe it when I see it. Or, you know, prove it to me and then I'll trust you. And that might be understandable in some situations with people or your financial advisor or your contractor or whatever. But let's not take those sorts of imaginations into a relationship with the Most High God. Plus, let's not be so arrogant to think that he hasn't already vastly proved himself in creation, in everything you read in Scripture, in the sending of his Son, Jesus Christ, in the giving of the Holy Spirit. He has vastly proved himself time and time again. And these are the kind of psalms that remind us, hey, nothing changed. God didn't do anything David asked yet, but David lies down in peace. Why? Because he knows who God is. Trouble's still lurking, but in the midst of trouble, joy and satisfaction. Look at Psalm 27. I do want to be clear. When I say we're trusting in his character, it's, like I said, not just the outcomes. God does do, obviously, as we're going to read, wondrous things. But it's not that we are only trusting him because he does that. Or he would do it in a way we expect him to. That's where we mostly get into trouble. Psalm 27. This one is interesting. This one begins with trust, sinks into some lament, and then rises back up to a confidence in God. Many psalms begin with lament and end with trust. This one goes through the waves. Of David, the Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the stronghold of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? So here, what is he comparing? God's character to worldly adversaries. The Lord is my light and my salvation. And if the Lord is this, then what are those things in comparison to him? This isn't an ignorant heart. I think it's not wise to pretend that fears or threats are not real. That's not what he's doing. He's just comparing them to his light and his salvation. God is greater than these things. When evildoers assail me to eat up my flesh, my adversaries and foes, it is they who stumble and fall. Though an army encamp against me, my heart shall not fear. Though wars arise against me, yet I will be confident. What is he confident in? You know, he's talking about when he's encamped by armies, which David was encamped by armies. He's a confident that God is still who he is, his light and his salvation. I always think of Psalm 56:3, which is, when I am afraid, I will trust in you, in God whose word I praise. So you have those moments and times of fearfulness because of a true and real threat. But when we are afraid, we turn our hearts to trust in God and to praise his word, which we praise God in his word because his word is reminding us of who he is, our light and salvation. And even though trouble is lurking, we can be reminded by his deeds of old. And then David says this, I love this. He's talking about armies being around him and people coming to eat up his flesh. And he says, one thing I've asked of the Lord, and that will I seek after, that he destroys all of my enemies in front of my face, and I get to see them bleed out on the battlefield. And everyone says how right I was. No, this is really cool. One thing I have asked of the Lord, that will I seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord and inquire in his temple. Not only is this a beautiful verse, it's a great, great gift that God could give. The privilege of spending time contemplating and reflecting on the wonderful beauty of God. And this teaches us a very valuable lesson. What is the psalmist asking for in the midst of trouble? Getting more of God in his life and heart. Gazing more upon God. And sometimes distracting fears cause us to think about and ponder and meditate upon and fear, stand in ever all in reverence of anything but God. And here David is saying, really what I'm asking for is I want more of a revelation of God in my eyes. I want to gaze upon his beauty. I want to be in his sanctuary again, learning of him. And one of the things that I think when we have present troubles, we feel like the last thing we have time for is to get more God. It's like, that obviously didn't work because why am I in trouble? But this is David's singular prayer. Encamped by armies, let me gaze upon your beauty. Verse 5, this is why. For he will hide me in his shelter in the days of trouble. He will conceal me under the shadow of his tent. He will lift me high upon a rock. And now my head shall be lifted up above all my enemies around me. And I will offer in his tent sacrifices with shouts of joy. I will sing and make melody to the Lord. So as David ponders God's faithfulness, as he thinks about his steadfast love, it causes confidence in him and a trust in him that God will act on his behalf once again. And what he's already thinking about is making offerings at the tabernacle and singing songs of praise to God for his greatness. Hear, O Lord, when I cry aloud, be gracious to me and answer me. You have said, seek my face. My heart says to you, your face, Lord, do I seek. Hide not your face from me. Turn not your servant away in anger. Oh, you have been my help. Cast me not off, forsake me not, O God of my salvation, for my father and my mother have forsaken me, but the Lord will take me in. So here we see that great truth. Keep seeking God's presence. God actually wants people to seek him. He is great enough to be sought. And so David says here, you said, seek my face. And he's saying, here I am seeking your face until you show grace to me. And the idea of keep on seeking is when we are continuing to seek after God, we're displaying to him that we're trusting him. We're displaying to him that we are seeking him alone as opposed to something else. So the seeking implies a process, right? I keep on seeking him. It's not I sought him and this happened, but I'm seeking him. And again, when we think of trust, a lot of times we think of, well, if I'm trusting God, I have certain outcomes that happen that are favorable, or I will receive a certain thing that I believed for. But that's not really it. Trust is in the middle. It's easy to look back and say, oh, God was right. Hindsight is 20/20, right? Trusting God is when you don't know what's going to happen. That's when the trust is put in. That's when we are seeking God, is when we don't have answers. And when we are waiting and when we're crying out, continuing to seek him despite the present trouble. So oftentimes when people are still in limbo, then they get concerned that they are not trusting God. But the trust is in the waiting. That is where the trust is found, in seeking his face and being assured here, like David was, that God would not leave him. Even closer than his mother and father, the Lord would pick him up. Isn't that something? So he says, in this waiting, in the seeking, teach me your way, O Lord. Lead me on the level path because of my enemies. I do have some real opposition here. Give me not up to the will of my adversaries, for false witnesses have riven against me and they breathe out violence. And then he says, I believe that I shall look upon the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. Wait for the Lord, be strong and let your heart take courage. Wait for the Lord. So you see this dogged persistence seeking, and then the satisfaction that comes from seeing the goodness of the Lord in the land of living. And the idea is like clinging. You know, don't let go of that trusting relationship with God. You will see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. Wait for him. Be strong. Let your heart be encouraged to trust in him. Let's go to Psalm 34. So that trust is displayed as we are waiting, yet seeking. And Psalm 34 displays a bit of what it feels like when you see that fruition of that trusting relationship. When you taste and see that the Lord is good and there is blessedness in putting your trust in Him. Psalm 34, verse 1. I will bless the Lord at all times. His praise shall continually be in my mouth. My soul makes its boast in the Lord. Let the humble hear and be glad. Oh, magnify the Lord with me. Let us exalt His name together. I sought the Lord, and He answered me and delivered me from all of my fears. Those who look to Him are radiant, and their faces shall never be ashamed. What's really beautiful about that, why are they radiant? Because they're looking at Him. It means His light is shining upon them. So they are radiant, and their faces are never ashamed. They are never disappointed in that looking to God. This poor man cried, the Lord heard him and saved him out of all of his troubles. The angel of the Lord encamps around those who fear Him and delivers them. So the sequence in this is in the first couple of verses, I have reasons to praise Him, so join me. Let's exalt His name together. And then here, in verses 4 and 5 and 6, he's saying, this is my experience. This poor man cried, and the Lord heard him and delivered him out of all of his fears. This could be your experience. So the encouragement here is those who look to Him are radiant. Now, we don't want to despair from trusting and seeking God in the midst of the troubles, or we're turning away from God's radiance. We're turning away from His light and salvation. Verse 8, it says, oh, taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the man who takes refuge in Him, or blessed is the man who trusts in Him. Oh, fear the Lord, you His saints, for those who fear Him have no lack. Remember that joy more than wine and grain? Lay down, peaceful sleep, soundly. They have no lack. The young lions suffer want and hunger, but those who seek the Lord lack no good thing. So the psalmist is calling on people to experience God's goodness personally and intimately by relying on Him in their times of distress. If they did that, He would not disappoint them. Those who look to Him are radiant, and they are never ashamed. And the opportunity that we all have is that we each get to taste and see that the Lord is good. And then blessed is that person who puts their trust in Him. There are other things that will look like good. And David says in another psalm, my goodness does not extend beyond you. There will be other avenues, other gods, little g gods, other sources, other helps that will seem like good. But really, trusting in God, in His character, in what He's doing, that is where true blessedness and satisfaction are. And this is so experiential. If you taste and see that the Lord is good and you really know that, nobody can really take that away from you. If you've only just heard about it, it's up for grabs. But when somebody truly has the tasting and seeing the nutritious relationship of knowing God, it's so much harder to be robbed from them because they know it themselves. They know it intimately. They know it personally. And that's joyous, right? That sounds really wonderful. And that's what David's inviting. Taste and see. This happened for me. I'm a poor man. I have no resources. He's the king, but he's a poor man. And the Lord delivered him out of all of his troubles. God's got all the resources. But taste and see, not God's resources alone. Taste and see that He is good. And blessed is that man that trusts in Him. Psalm 63. When it comes to trust and satisfaction, what we'll see in this psalm is David's dependence upon God, his recognition that God's love is better than life itself, and he thirsts for God in a way that he sees his daily and hourly need for God's presence and a relationship with Him. When our trust turns away from God, ultimately, or when our seeking is turning away from God, ultimately we're starting to put our trust in something or someone else. And much of what these Psalms are fighting for our hearts for and encouraging God's people in is there is a blessedness and satisfaction that comes only from a trusting relationship with God. And so here in Psalm 63, this one's when David's in the wilderness of Judah and away from the formal place of worship where the Ark of God is. This could have been when he was on the run from Saul, or it could have been when he was on the run when he was king from Absalom, his own son. And look at how he wakes up in the desert and says this in verse 1. O God, you are my God. Earnestly or early I seek you. My soul thirsts for you. My flesh faints for you in a dry and weary land where there is no water. So imagine being on the run in the wilderness, waking up, and how visceral that need for sustenance would be. Life essential to water. Something to feed you and help you and sustain you. And his first thought is, actually, what I really need here is not a cold glass of water. I need you, God. I need your presence with me. So, verse 2, I have looked upon you in the sanctuary, beholding your power and glory. And I kind of like this thought. It's like he wakes up and he's thirsty. Right? Probably if you've been on the run or battle or something like that, probably pretty visceral, probably pretty profound. But he wakes up and he goes, oh, really, today what I need is your presence, God. I need you. And then he looks back. So in verse 2, I have looked upon you in the sanctuary, beholding your power and glory. And I think this is a really remarkable way that this psalm is put, because we have a present danger and a present emergency and a present trouble. But his view of that present trouble is informed by what he already knew about God. That time and space in the sanctuary, the presence of God, the worship of God, where he's beholding, he's really understanding God's power and God's glory. So now that's informing how he is dealing with his current trouble. So often in practice, people tend to treat God as like for emergencies only, like, you know, don't break the glass until you really need them, kind of thing. And the problem with an emergencies only God is when the emergency actually arrives, we don't know him with a trusting relationship like we ought to. So there isn't that deep, sort of profound understanding that what I need today is what I needed yesterday and for all the thousands of times before that, which is a revelation of God's presence in my life. And so David here, he's drawing from the past. He's drawing from his time and understanding of who God is, so that when the trials are coming, we already know God. I think that's such a huge, huge way to relate to God. And then he says this in verse 3, because your steadfast love is better than life, my lips will praise you. So I will bless you as long as I live. In your name, I lift up my hands. So here he speaks pretty profoundly that God's love, God's faithful love, is better than life itself. Maybe you slept on a rock that night for a pillow and saying, God's love is better than life itself. This was what was satisfying him, like, thirst to, like a water to his thirst of his soul. For his fainting flesh was God's steadfast love. So you have a guy where not everything is going right in his life, so to speak, and to some pretty probably massive levels. And yet he's thinking back on the power and glory of God, a revelation of God in his sanctuary, and saying, that love that you have for me is better than life, so I'll praise you. And then he says this, my soul will be satisfied as with fat and rich food, and my mouth will praise you with joyful lips when I remember you upon my bed and I meditate on you in the night watches. So he's thinking about God and God's faithful, steadfast love, and that brought fullness into his life, like being satisfied with fat and rich food, truly filled. And so that was his soul with God. His soul was truly filled. And his meditation of God was in the morning, he wakes up and says, I have need of you. Early will I seek you. And then into the night watches, he is meditating and remembering God upon his bed. And again, this is what we looked at last week, that thinking upon and meditating upon the greatness of God is what will actually cause our hearts to worship him. What will cause us to call out to him and to praise him? If we have no space to be mindful of him, we'll have very little space for trust in him and praise of him, especially in times of trouble or darkness. Verse 7, for you have been my help, and in the shadow of your wings, I will sing for joy. My soul clings to you. Your right hand upholds me. Isn't that beautiful? My soul clings to you, knowing God sustains him, upholds him. But those who seek to destroy my life shall go into the depths of the earth. They shall be given over to the power of the sword. They shall be a portion for jackals. But the king shall rejoice in God. All who swear by him shall exult, for the mouth of liars will be stopped. And ultimately, God's going to take care of the adversaries against him. We don't know how this shook out for David this time, or how it looks maybe in our lives sometimes, but we do know that God is righteous and that vengeance belongs to him. And we have his steadfast love, and therefore that's better than life. So that evens out your enemies. What can your enemies take from you? Well, even if they take your life, which is in David's case, what they cannot take from him is the steadfast love of God, and to him that is better than life. Does that make sense? So then he can view his enemies for what they are, and he can view God for what or who he is. Let's go one psalm back to close, Psalm 62. Psalm 61, 62, 63, kind of read them together. They flow together. This one goes to the choir master as well. Would have been neat to sing this. Verse 1 of Psalm 62, it says, for God alone, my soul waits in silence. From him comes my salvation. He alone is my rock and my salvation, my fortress. I shall not be greatly shaken. So God alone is the rest of the soul and the true help. And so intrinsic in that idea is if it's God alone, it means it's not man and it's not other things, right? It's him alone. And so this is setting up this whole psalm of trusting in God alone, waiting on him or something else. And this psalmist, he waits in silence. And that means he's basically waiting quietly and patiently till his help comes. And he does it with a recognition that God alone, God only, is his rock, salvation, and fortress. And because of this, he won't be greatly shaken. And I like that it says that. He won't be greatly shaken. He might be shaken a bit. You know, there's that seesaw a little bit. There's that a little bit, but not greatly shaken when we are waiting and putting our trust in God alone. He says, how long will all of you attack a man to batter him like a leaning wall or tottering fence? They plan to thrust him down from his high position. They take pleasure in falsehood. They bless with their mouths, but inwardly they curse, Selah. David has a lot of enemies, doesn't he? I think we're seeing this. But he's a bit incredulous that his enemies think they can kind of topple him like a leaning wall or like some flimsy fence. And why is he incredulous about this? Again, he alone is my rock and my salvation. He's putting his trust in not his own resources, not his own might, not his own power, but in God and who he is. So this active pressure against him pushes him to trust God even further. That is a wonderful lesson. Sometimes we get active pressure, and then that makes us to scramble to everything else or any other source or any other help other than our Father. Verse 4, here he shifts. He starts speaking to himself, his own soul. He says, for God alone, O my soul, wait in silence, for my hope is in from him. He only is my rock and my salvation, my fortress. I shall not be shaken, getting a little more confident. On God rest my salvation and my glory, my mighty rock, my refuge is God. And this is a high view of God's trustworthiness, a high view of God's nature and character, a right reliance upon God as his only And he's speaking this to his soul. My soul, wait in silence. He's reminding himself of what was true earlier in the song. God alone is my rock and my salvation. He tells himself and reminds himself to wait for God and to put his hope in him. And how wonderfully important this is to encourage our own hearts, to not allow our fleeting thoughts or emotional responses to run wild. They're telling us something, but let's direct those things toward God. Whether it be fears or anxieties or doubts or worries or pride or selfishness or reliance upon a false God or idol, whatever it is, fighting for the heart to come back to wait upon God. And here it says again, wait in silence, which is a powerful portrait of what it looks like to trust God. Again, that trust is in the waiting, not just the outcomes, right? Well, you're trusting him before something happens. You're trusting him while you're in it, so to speak. And we will do more. We will accomplish more in simply doing nothing, waiting, than we would do by doing all of our own very best activities by our own devices. If we start walking apart from God, we will do far less than had we stood silently waiting. And I think part of this silence here, this is not in the sense you're not speaking to God or he's not speaking to you. And although there may be silence for long periods of time from God on something, the silence is in the sense of not being all hopped up, but understanding that God does see and hear. And so you're patiently waiting. Your soul is weaned, waiting at God's throne, being patient before him with a stillness. Waiting is paramount to having a real relationship with anybody, including God. If we don't wait on people, we never get to know them, right? So if we don't wait on God, also, we lack in knowing him. We lack in trusting him, in allowing him to be wiser than we are, to do things in the best possible way, which is his way. And we'll end up not knowing him at all and just knowing our own ways, because we won't wait on him. Instead, we'll just do whatever it is we think we should do. Verse 8, it says, trust in him at all times, O people. So now we have, whenever you see those big O's, that's evocative. It means you, people. So earlier it was, O my soul, you soul. Trust in him at all times, O people. Pour out your heart before him. God is a refuge for us, Selah. So he turns from his own soul, putting courage in his own heart to trust God. Now he wants to put courage in the people's heart. You trust in him at all times. Why? God is a refuge for us. So essentially, David is saying, do you want what I have here? Well, here's the recipe. Pour out your heart, trust in him at all times, and God is. Know who he is. He's your help. He's your satisfaction. He is your refuge. Those of low estate are but a breath. Those of high estate, you know, the high and mighty people, they're our delusion. In the balances, they go up and they are lighter than a breath. Put no trust in extortion. Set no hope, vain hopes on robbery. These are the ways people go, right? Well, if I need it, I guess I could just steal it, right? Or what if riches increase? Well, if I just had enough resources, then I could do this for myself. Then set not your heart on them. Basically, he's saying low estate or high estate, everybody's a breath. Our human resources are comparatively insignificant. And so it's unwise, because all humans are temporary and their resources are fleeting. So their products are poor compared to waiting in silence upon the Lord. Why is that really important? Because again, in the waiting, what do you want to do in the waiting? You're tempted to look at other sources, right? You're tempted to turn from looking at the radiance of God and look to the radiance of this other resource over here or that resource over there. But come back to the point of this song. God alone is my help. He alone, my hope and trust are only in him. And to close, he says, once God has spoken, twice have I heard this, that power belongs to God. And that to you, O Lord, belongs steadfast love. Remember that steadfast love is better than life. for you will render to a man according to his work. So human power is weak, divine power is mighty. God's steadfast love is a real thing to experience, to taste and see, and it actually belongs only to him. You can only get it in one place. You can only get real, faithful love in one place, in God. And so we trust him above all else, and people are constantly needing to decide whether they're going to trust these things of God, which are unseen, or trust something that they can't see. And God will render to every person according to their work. So at the end of days, the satisfaction and blessedness of trusting God and tasting and seeing that the Lord is good will come down to the end of days as well. A life that's lived that God will commend and God will give honor to in trusting him. I think for a closing thought for you and me, for those who are not King David but are on this side of Jesus's accomplishments on the cross and the resurrection, is if you ever doubt God's goodness, if you can ever doubt that is God working, think back always to his most wondrous act of love and his most inexpressible gift, which is his son, Jesus Christ. He gave his son on the cross into resurrection, and the cross and the empty tomb are our constant banner of God's love and our constant reminder of the mighty deeds of God and our constant reminder of God's relentless working even when we don't understand it. Because again, we would have been on that road to Emmaus like the disciples and said, we thought he was the one. We would have been at the tomb weeping that the Lord is dead. All the things that the human heart fickly does, we do. And when we look back for us to trust in God's character, look back to that when it looked like there was no king in Israel, there was no salvation to be had, that out of a stump sprouted out of Messiah, and the Messiah gave himself and rose from the dead when nobody expected that to happen. So for us in our hearts, you ever need something to trust in? What has God ever done? What has he done for me lately? Go back to that great work of God through Jesus Christ. That's his true steadfast love on display. So that's what I wanted to share with you tonight.
Thanks for joining us for our Psalm series. Next time, we'll see how vital thankfulness is in the heart and prayer life of a faithful Christian. At PA Bible, we welcome you to join us in gospel-centered, scripturally devoted fellowship as we make much of our God and the Lord Jesus Christ.